Iran's leader blames the United States and Israel for masterminding the recent riots in Iran. Pakistan demands prompt international help as it is still reeling from the recent devastating floods. And the United States holds separate military drills with South Korea and Japan amid escalating tensions with North Korea. This is World News. I'm Behruz Najafi. Welcome. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says that the recent riots in the country were plotted by the U.S., Israel, and their paid agents. Ayatollah Sayyid Khamenei made a comment addressing cadets in Tehran. The leader said that he was saddened by the death of a young woman that triggered the riots, but he said that the reactions to that incident, including insecurity on the streets and the burning of the Holy Quran and mosques, were not normal. Ayatollah Khamenei said that the death of the young woman was a pretext for some foreign governments to foment insecurity and rioting. The leader said that such governments cannot tolerate Iran's progress and power.
Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has severely censured the unrest that erupted in some parts of Iran following the death of a young woman, stating that the deadly riots were orchestrated in advance by the United States and the Israeli regime. Ayatollah Khamenei made the comment in an address to military cadets in Tehran, saying he was saddened by the death of a young woman, which triggered the riots. Protests over the death of Mahsa Amini, a 22-year-old Iranian woman who fainted at a police station and was later pronounced dead at a hospital, erupted first in her native province of Kurdistan and later spread to other parts of the country, including Tehran. The leader said reactions to the incident were not normal. The riots were not natural, as groups of people caused social disturbances on the streets, burned copies of the Holy Quran, harassed veiled women, and set mosques, religious congregational halls, and private cars on fire. According to a statement released by the Iranian intelligence ministry, the rioters have been backed by Western regimes and their mercenary media, who disseminated misinformation and distorted the sequence of events that led to Amini's death, even before the official investigation into the incident concludes. Also, the intelligence ministry said 9 people from Germany, Poland, Italy, France, the Netherlands, Sweden, and other countries have been arrested for their role in the riots. From the very beginning, different Western media began a campaign against Iran voicing support for the rioters. That's why they have remained silent for years about the strict sanctions imposed on Iran. Meanwhile, a teenage girl named Zainab Essa Majid al-Khazali was killed during American military drills near a U.S. military camp close to the international airport in the Iraqi capital Baghdad. There was an effective blackout on the death in Western media. So why are they refusing to show the same sensibility about Zainab's death? Seemingly, what matters most is creating turmoil in the stable nations in West Asia.
Iran supports peaceful protests, accepting it as the right of every nation. But when it comes to national security, every country takes measures to stop unrest before it could turn into a full-blown crisis. A good instance can be the UK's reaction to recent protests outside the Iran embassy that turned violent, with the London mayor promising to bring those who try to hijack the protests to justice. Now, shouldn't we call it a double standard, as the UK was against Iranians protesting there, but London is okay with those protesting and rioting inside Iran?
Shortly after the death of Mahsa Amini, allegations of mistreatment and even torture surfaced on social media platforms, and Western media outlets lost no time in picking up the story and willfully distorting it. Before any official statement was made, Iran was accused of deliberate killing, and Mahsa was brutally killed by Iranian police was the talk of the town. Unsurprisingly, these headlines come as part of a systematic campaign to attack Iran and cause turmoil in the country.
There have been more anti-government protests in the Iranian capital, Tehran.
Just a moment ago, protests spreading in the country of Iran over the death of a young woman earlier this month.
The protests in Iran.
In addition, for years, the West, particularly the United States, has been trying to stop Iran's progress by using economic sanctions, military threats, cyber attacks, and assassinations. In his remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei said the U.S. and its allies' main problem is a strong and independent Iran and the country's progress. He pointed to the country's progress in all sectors, efforts aimed at facilitating domestic production, activation of knowledge-based companies, and the country's ability to neutralize Western sanctions. The leader said that enemies are gravely mistaken in their calculations, and their plots will not yield anything at all. And he's right. Iranians once again foiled the enemy's plots after huge crowds of people took to the streets across Iran to denounce acts of vandalism and desecration of Islamic sanctities by rioters, sending a strong message that Iran's security and stability is the most important issue.
Muslims in London have rallied to denounce recent Islamophobic violence in the British capital amid ongoing anti-Iran riots. Following the death of the Iranian woman, several Western anti-Iran groups staged demonstrations in European cities in which Muslims and police have been attacked. Robert Carter, a London correspondent, reports some Muslims in the city remained fearful of future attacks.
Muslims in London were compelled to mobilize outside an Islamic center on Saturday following recent Islamophobic violence by anti-Iran protesters. On Sunday, the 25th of September, London witnessed an outpouring of anti-Muslim attacks as protesters claiming to support Mirza Amini were filmed attacking Shia Muslims commemorating Arba'een and the Iranian Islamic Center of England, following clashes with police outside Iran's embassy.
Last week, our mosque was attacked. Our procession was attacked. People were attacked that weren't even Iranian, had nothing, they didn't know anything about what was going on. And it impedes our freedom of religion in this country.
Protests over the death of Amini, a 22-year-old Iranian woman who fell to the floor at a police station on September the 16th, started shortly after her death was announced. Those protests soon turned into violent riots, with masked people attacking security officers, resorting to vandalism and desecrating religious sanctities, including hijab burnings. Dissident groups outside of Iran were quick to board the bandwagon, engaging in violent protests throughout Europe, especially in London and Paris.
We've got people not of an Iranian origin, but in fact of multinational origin who've come out here to direct their anger to these people who are loaded with anti-Islamic people, LGBT people, and all elements which are anti-Islam who've come out here to side with an event which has happened in Iran. But really, they don't care about that event.
Saturday's demonstration passed by peacefully without any major incidents occurring. However, locals informed me that they remained deeply concerned that future attacks may take place. They also informed me that they were deeply frustrated that the local authorities who failed to protect the community. Robert Carter, London.
Canada has imposed fresh sanctions on 34 Iranian individuals and entities over alleged human rights violations. The sanctions list announced by the Canadian Foreign Minister includes 25 people and 9 entities, including English News Network, Press TV. Now, that a week after Prime Minister Justin Trudeau pledged to impose sanctions on the Iranian government. It's not the first time that Canada has come up with such measures against Iran, with which it doesn't have any diplomatic relations. Ottawa has blacklisted around 200 Iranian entities and individuals in the past two. Human rights activist Firas Al-Najm believes that Canada's blacklisting of Press TV is the prime example of undermining freedom of the press.
This is a very biased move, and it's also because of a lot of pressure from Zionist lobbies in Canada and the Conservative Party. They're pushing heavily on this issue. They are trying to, hurt the Iranian government in any way. And they're, working day and night to, fraction the relations between the Canadian government and the Iranian government. And, we see that this is contradictory to what they stand for, because in the Charter of Rights, the freedoms for the press is open. So, you know, even your opposition should have a right to speak out and to express his opinion and give his information. And you have a right to, oppose that or, bring your proof and provide it in your own media. So for you to sanction something, they did the same thing also with RT, right? Russian TV, they did that also in July because of the ongoing battle between Ukraine and Russia. And for them being biased and being on the Ukrainian side fully. So, this is a way to try to silence the press TV and their media and the Iranian government side. They are not really fighting for justice. They're not really fighting for humanity. They're not really fighting for human rights. And this really, at the end, really hurts and damages the Canadian image and the Canadian history and the Canadian government, with this issue.
Now, Pakistan calling for international help as the South Asian country is out of money to deal with the aftermath of devastating floods. The climate change minister acknowledged that her country cannot afford to spend more and that it's in urgent need of medicines for more than 8 million people. Sheikh Rahman said that Pakistan would need to import extra food as well. She urged the international community to accelerate humanitarian aid as over 7 million displaced people are in need of immediate support. Pakistan's Minister for Economic Affairs also warned that it would take years for the country to rebuild and rehabilitate those who have lost their homes and property. Meantime, the UN has revised its humanitarian aid appeal for Pakistan fivefold to $816 million.
What we are launching today is an appeal which is very much focused on the immediacy. It is very much focused on the humanitarian needs, the life-saving needs. We moved from an appeal of $162 million to one which today is going to be launched at $816 million. That's a significant increase.
The UN World Food Program says that Pakistan is entering the second wave of a health crisis caused by waterborne diseases. In its appeal, the agency said over 5 million people are facing severe food crisis in the aftermath of the floods. The floods were caused by abnormal monsoon rains that officials blame on climate change. The rain submerged large parts of land, including crops, roads, livestock, houses, and washed away infrastructure. Some 1,700 people were killed and some 33 million people affected by the natural disaster. Based on government estimates, the floods caused $30 billion in damages. 7 years ago, on October 3rd, U.S. Air Raids destroyed a trauma hospital run by Doctors Without Borders in Afghanistan's Kunduz city. 42 people were killed in that attack, including patients, caretakers, and hospital staff. Our correspondent reports from Kabul.
Back on October 3, 2015, this Doctors Without Borders hospital in Kunduz was reduced to rubble after being hit by a U.S. deadly airstrike. 211 shells were fired in the strike, lasting almost 1 hour. The charity hospital later announced that 42 civilians, including staffers and patients, were killed, and dozens of others were wounded.
Throughout the NATO coalition presence in Afghanistan, there were a lot of blind airstrikes and rights violations against Afghan civilians, especially by American air forces. The 2015 attack on Kunduz Charity Hospital was one of those atrocities and the biggest of its kind. As I remember, it was so deadly and devastating. Hospitals in war zones are protected under the Fourth Geneva Convention, and attacks on them should be tried as a war crime.
After initially denying the building being targeted, the U.S. eventually claimed responsibility for the airstrikes, justifying that it had been a serious and tragic mistake.
Independently and impartially.
The MSF called it a breach of international humanitarian law and a war crime, demanding for an independent probe. But an independent investigation or trial has never been conducted against the U.S. forces' atrocities.
یونیسف هم اگر گفته جرایم جنگی اگر باشه نهادهای بین المللی برای اجرا کردن و بررسی کردن و
محاکمه. The MSF and rights bodies believe that the US deadly air raid on Charity Hospital could be prosecuted as a war crime, but the international courts and bodies failed to conduct a trial because they are controlled by arrogant powers. They are funded by those countries and obey them. Besides, the U.S. has never agreed to turn any of their service members over to an outside judicial body. As a result, the case of the Kunduz attack was shot by Washington with a mere discipline of some American personnel, and no one was criminally charged.
Throughout the two-decade U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, there had been more than 13,000 airstrikes conducted by American forces in the country. The U.S. drone war on Afghanistan killed more than 4,000 people, including women and children. The U.S. airstrike on the Charity Hospital in Kunduz is one of the many instances of American forces' atrocities on Afghan soil. People here say the U.S. should be held accountable for crimes it has committed in Afghanistan. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The United States has conducted separate military drills with South Korea and Japan as tensions rise with North Korea. During the drills with Japan, U.S. F-35 warplanes took part with Japanese F-15 and F-2 fighter jets. Japan's defense ministry said that the aim was to confirm the two countries' readiness in dealing with any situation. U.S. and South Korean warplanes also conducted bombing drills in the Yellow Sea. Seoul said it mobilized four F-15 fighter jets that, together with American warplanes, dropped a pair of guided bombs on a target off the country's west coast. Now, the drills came after North Korea test fired an intermediate-range ballistic missile over Japan. That was the first time that a North Korean projectile passed through Japanese airspace since 2017. South Korea warns of a decisive response.
North Korea's such reckless nuclear provocation will face resolute response from our military as well as our allies and the international community.
North Korea's missile test also drew angry reaction from the European Union. EU chief Charles Michel called the launch unjustified aggression and a blatant violation of international law. The United Nations also condemned the escalation. Tensions have run high on the Korean Peninsula for months. Pyongyang has test-fired short-range ballistic missiles five times in over a week, and that in retaliation for joint anti-submarine drills by South Korea, Japan, and the U.S. North Korea considers those maneuvers as rehearsals for an invasion. It accuses the U.S. and its regional allies of threatening it with war games and military buildups. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, you heard the story of Imam Khomeini's arrival in Neuville-le-Château, a village around Paris, and we told you how his wife, Ms. Khadija Saghafi, would patiently receive guests and answer the questions on Islam and Imam Khomeini's movement. Today we are going to continue the story. We hope you'll enjoy it. Upon his arrival in Paris, Imam Khomeini resided at a three-room flat in Paris. But as the guest number increased, the Imam decided to change his residence. Hence, Neuville-le-Château village in the vicinity of Paris was chosen. Although the new house was a large villa, there were too many guests, especially students and journalists, so that a tent was set up in the yard. Some of the students would even stay there at nights. Imam Khomeini would perform midday congregational prayer in the yard and then deliver speech. Thus, the small village of Neuville-le-Château soon turned into the center of the news in the world. Haj Ahmad, the Imam's younger son, said on those days, "We were informed that, fortunately, our neighbor was going to leave, so we immediately hired the house. We used to do some of the affairs at the same house in Paris, so anyone who came to visit the Imam could sojourn there for one or two nights. A bus and two minibuses would commute Paris Neuville-le-Château route. The bus driver was a detainee of the Shah regime, and the three minibus drivers were Iranians. One of them was a surgeon, and the other two were students." Dear listeners, unlike Tehran, winter in Paris was very cold, so that often there were icicles hanging from roofs. Therefore, heating was difficult. But the inhabitants would wear warm clothes, and Imam Khomeini would perform congregational prayer in the yard. The affairs of women were administered by a young lady called Miss Marzieh Dabbagh. She would check any package not to contain a bomb. The affairs of men were also administered by Mr. Mehdi Araqi, who was described by Imam Khomeini as equal to 20 men. Araqi would sleep very little, and he would say, "It is the time of working and endeavor as I have rested in prison." This was while, according to his inmates, he would rest very little, even in prison. During the short stay in Paris, Imam Khomeini's wife, Ms. Khadija Saghafi, visited a few places in the city like the Eiffel Tower. She'd also paid a visit to some of her relatives who lived in Paris. On January 16, 1979, the Shah and his wife, Farah, left Iran for Aswan in Egypt. They had already sent their three children to the U.S. Therefore, his escape from the country was the top news of the day. So the news soon reached Paris, and everyone was happy, even some of the foreign journalists in Neuville-le-Château. Everyone was waiting for Imam Khomeini's reaction to the news. Ahmad Agha went to him and told him that everyone was waiting to hear his words on the event.
Yet, Imam Khomeini said that due to the approach of the time for midday prayer, he had not enough time to answer all questions. However, he sat on a chair behind the bars of the yard and congratulated the Iranian people on the Shah escape in cold blood. Then, he stressed that the event was the end of the Shah criminal era. He added that he would soon announce his political statement. His statement had emphasized on a few things. The formation of provisional government, the ratification of the new constitution, and his return to Iran in the first proper time. Dear listeners, if you remember, we had spoken about the reaction of Imam Khomeini's wife on the news of the Shah escape from the country. She had said that if the Shah had listened to the Imam's advice in 1962 to join the nation and turn his back to the bullying governments, he could have stayed in the country. This clearly showed that the Imam and his family had no personal enmity with the despotic Pahlavi regime and their agents, but they were opposed to their corrupt and criminal way of ruling. Ms. Saghafi said on her stay in Nufel Lo Chateau village, "My few months' stay in the rural house in Nufel Lo Chateau was very pleasant and lovely. I was sprightly and enjoyed being with the guests."
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
How do we bring, this is just going to be very brief, how do we bring the akhirah from being just a belief, mental acrobatics, to being something that now it changes the way I believe, my determinations, my calculations, when I'm patient, how I'm strong, how I resist. How do I get this belief to translate into action? Even the, again, let's think about these things. I want to give two examples, two case studies. They took place in the Islamic Republic of Iran, just to give us a little closer to the concept. Even if we thought there was a possibility of an akhirah, it changes you in a revolutionary way. The possibility of an akhirah. We'll see later how this affects our patience. There was a university student. This is in the Islamic Republic. A girl, a young lady, who's going to the university. And this young lady, when you looked at her, apparently, with hijab, salah, fasting, these kind of things, even her questions, her attitude when it came to the religion, you would say that this young lady, she doesn't believe in any deen. Living in the Islamic Republic. What's so interesting, though, was that her university professor, he met her later on. So he knew her, he met her, he talked to her. Every time, defiant. And then later he saw her, and now she's wearing the hijab. She's practicing, she's praying. Everything's different now. So then the university teacher, he said, "You don't mind, what happened? I mean, you're very different now." And the young lady told him a story. He said that what happened was, up until now, whenever I would think about the akhirah, I would say that it's something made up. Who knows if there's an akhirah? People make these things up. It's all a lie, all a game. And that's when you saw me, and I was my regular self. He said, one day, I thought to myself, he said, I can't say for sure that there is an akhirah. There is an akhirah. But can I say for sure that there isn't? He said, 100%. She's by herself thinking about it. She was like, if there isn't an akhirah, then if I turn into dust, it doesn't matter what I did here in the dunya. I enjoyed myself. I didn't enjoy myself. Whatever, in the end, I die. We're all going to die. But if there is an akhirah, for everything I did, I'm going to have to give the account and pay it back forever. She said, just that question, it robbed me of all joy. Until I came to a conclusion. He said, no, there's an akhirah now. So just the possibility of there being an akhirah, let alone what we have as mu'mineen, faith, belief. But the idea is, now let's talk about patience. How does this help me to develop revolutionary patience in a situation which is unfair, which is difficult, which is long, which is hard, where I'm not at fault? How does belief in the akhirah help me to develop revolutionary patience? What they tell us is this. Let me give you the case study. They tell us is this. Whatever difficulty you and I are facing, think of that in terms of eternity and the akhirah, where we're really going. I'm going through difficulty right now. Life isn't fair right now. You're telling me, Islam says, be patient, resist, do my responsibility. How long will I have to resist here compared to the hereafter, the akhirah? I'm going to mention that hadith from the Ahlul Bayt, where Imam Hussein, that one beautiful hadith, because the height of it is in Karbala. Remember those companions in Karbala, Imam Ali says that no one will ever be like them. There was never anyone like them before. There will never be anyone like them. We have shuhada now. We might even compare them to the shuhada of Badr and Uhud. But were they like the companions of Imam Hussein? No. How much belief was there in the akhirah? I'll mention the words of Imam Hussein. But comparing our... So I'll give you the case study. The case study was this. It happened in the Islamic Republic. There was a woman who she and her husband were about to get divorced. So they've now separated from one another. Unfortunately, they were now separated. That's a bad idea, but they had separated. They're living a month apart. And now they hear such and such sheikh is coming to their area. The friends are worried, concerned. Why don't you sit down and talk with the sheikh? They agree. The husband and wife agree. So now both of them are sitting, which is the right way to do it. You have both people sitting there. The girl explained, she said that actually, me and my husband, we don't have a serious problem with one another. We're fine. It's our in-laws. His relatives. They're the ones who are. And it wasn't just the mother and father, it was also the brother. His brother. So they're zalimin, they're oppressive, they're interfering, they're doing these things. And now I'm reached the breaking point. Now I'm done. And the sheikh says her husband was also there, and he agreed. So he's listening, and he says, it's true. He said, but they're all, I've tried, I've spoken to them, I've done my responsibility. They're being zalimin. My father, he's too old, he's not going to change my mother. So sheikh now turns back to the young lady. He said, so I've understood what happened. He said, he didn't have the opportunity to go and talk to her father and her mother and her brother. No, no, in-laws, I can't talk to them. He said, but I can't talk to her. He said, so your husband's here, and what you just said was correct. Your situation is unbearable. It's very difficult. They're zalimin. Your husband's confirmed that this is actually correct. So, yeah. He said, I want to ask you a couple of questions. He said, if you knew that you would only live until tomorrow, so you had one day to live, and then after that you're going to go to the akhirah. One day. How would you feel about the problems you're currently in? So you're going to die. Tomorrow is it. It's all over. You know, you're going, how would you feel about the problems you're currently in? Would that be your greatest concern? Thought about it for a second. If I'm going to go meet Allah, Akhira, and I know, I have another question for you. So, if you knew that you were going to meet Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that wouldn't be your greatest concern. Wouldn't be my greatest concern. He said, what about if someone came to you? Because, you know, like, when we're encouraging one another to be patient, one part of it, we empathize with the person who's going through the difficulties. That's true. He said, so let's say there was someone who came over to you and was like, I agree with you. Your father-in-law is so wrong. Your mother-in-law is like this. Your brother, right? He said that at this stage, they're agreeing with you. Would you appreciate their concern? Knowing that you're going to go to meet Allah tomorrow. She's like, not the time. Lord, telling me how terrible it is. I've got other bigger things. Akhirah. Another question for you. He said, so not only if you, he said that, do you know that you're alive tomorrow? If you had yaqeen that you were only going to live until tomorrow, you wouldn't. He said, do you have yaqeen that you're alive tomorrow? Who knows how? But see what happened? The akhirah, belief in the akhirah, being present in the mind. I'm going to meet God. My biggest concern. If it can be brought into our lives, then it changes how we think. The verses of Quran now, and sorry, the hadith, first of all, with Imam Hussein, what he says is that's the letter he wrote on the 6th of Muharram. He said this, فَكَأَنَّ الدُّنْيَا لَمْ تَكُنْ. The akhirah is so real, it's as if the dunya never existed. وَكَأَنَّ الْآخِرَةِ. It's as if the akhirah لَمْ تَزَلْ. As if it was always present. It was always the akhirah. If that's the case, if I'm only going to be here for a little while, no matter what my difficulty is, and there's those rewards in me meeting my maker, what should I do in my current situation? This is a hadith from our Prophet. It says, "Ad-dunya sah." This dunya, as long as we're here, is a moment. Faj'alha tah. Make it obedience. Use the opportunity. These are now ayat of the Quran. We don't have time. I'm going to end now. We can look in the ayat of the Quran about this. No matter what we've been given of the dunya, whether it is a difficult and intolerable situation or blessings that are beyond belief, the way that Islam wants us to feel is not that I've been honored by God if things are going my way, or to feel disrespected by God if I'm in a challenging situation, but rather to use either that blessing or that difficulty to get closer to God, to gain the akhirah. Whether it's good or bad, ad-dunya sa'a, it's only a moment. Faj'alha, use that situation, faj'alha ta'a.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Adi عليم حال حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Thank you.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The United Kingdom government, which supported the establishment of the fabricated regime of Israel decades ago, is now moving further toward the Zionist regime and its sinister goals. There are reports that new British Prime Minister Liz Truss has already promised Zionist regime Prime Minister Yair Lapid that she will review whether to move the UK's embassy to Al-Quds. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. Middle East Eye wrote, during her campaign for the leadership of the British Conservative Party, Liz Truss told the Conservative Friends of Israel, CFI, that if elected, she would consider relocating the British embassy from Tel Aviv to Al-Quds. At a subsequent meeting at the UN, Prime Minister Truss repeated the promise of a review to her friend Yair Lapid, the interim Zionist regime prime minister. The status of Al-Quds is the thorniest issue, one of the most bitter, prolonged and intractable international conflicts of modern times. East Al-Quds, along with the rest of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, were captured by the fabricated regime of Israel in June 1967 war and have ever since been viewed by the international community as occupied territory. The Zionist regime officials were naturally delighted that Truss floated the idea of moving the embassy to Al-Quds and thereby recognizing the Zionist regime's sovereignty over the city as one of her first foreign policy moves as prime minister. Palestinian leaders have warned that moving the embassy would undermine the two-state solution and destroy their relations with Britain. Hossam Zulmot, the Palestinian ambassador to the UK, said it was extremely unfortunate that Truss used her first appearance at the UN as prime minister to commit to potentially breaking international law. Middle East Eye added, it is difficult to think of a foreign policy issue that is less indeed of a review than the location of the British embassy in the occupied Palestinian territories. Moving the embassy to Al-Quds would violate a raft of UN resolutions and amount to an abrupt reversal of British policy since 1967. This policy, part of a broad international consensus, has held that all embassies should stay in Tel Aviv until a comprehensive peace agreement is reached, with Al-Quds as the shared capital of the two states. During her tenure as Foreign Secretary, Truss made no attempts to relocate the embassy. One can only speculate that she instigated a review for reasons of political expediency. To ingratiate herself with the Zionist regime and its supporters in Britain, and more specifically with CFI, whose membership includes most of the cabinet and around 80% of Tory backbenchers. One Israeli newspaper recently described Truss as potentially the most pro-Israel British prime minister ever. This was no doubt intended as praise, but it ignores Britain's historic responsibility for creating the problem in the first place. It all began with the Balfour Declaration of 1917 in support of a national home for the Jewish people in the land of Palestine, although the Jews were only 10% of the country's population at that time. The commitment that this would not be at expense of non-Jewish communities was completely ignored by successive British governments. The declaration thus enabled a systematic Zionist colonial takeover of Palestine, a process that is still ongoing. U.S. President Donald Trump was first world leader to break the long-standing agreement of the international community not to base embassies in Al-Quds until a two-state solution to the conflict is reached. His decision to move the American embassy to Al-Quds in 2018 was met with outrage across the world and provoked widespread international condemnation. It also led to a flare-up of violence in which dozens of Palestinians were martyred by the Zionist regime forces. Theresa May, the British Prime Minister at the time, criticized the move. Trump's much-vaunted deal of the century was a crude attempt to redefine the two-state solution as Greater Israel, as they baselessly claim, including about a third of the West Bank and the whole of Al-Quds, and a fragmented Palestinian state surrounded by Zionist regime settlements and military bases. It was promptly and contemptuously rejected by Palestinians. Despite Trump's best efforts, only three states have followed his example of moving their embassies to Al-Quds, including Kosovo, Guatemala, and Honduras. All other 82 countries with diplomatic missions in the occupied Palestinian territories opted to keep their embassies in Tel Aviv. Some of these countries, including Britain, also have a consulate general in East Al-Quds, which serves as a channel of communication with the PA in Ramallah. In her singularly pro-Israel stance and apparent indifference to Palestinian rights, Truss belongs to the mainstream of her party. All three prime ministers under whom she served have been staunch supporters of the fabricated regime of Israel. David Cameron described himself as a passionate friend of Israel and insisted that nothing could break that friendship. Theresa May was probably the most pro-Zionist leader in Europe during her premiership. In an address to CFI in 2016, she described the fabricated regime of Israel as a remarkable country, a thriving democracy, a beacon of tolerance, as she claimed baselessly. She furiously rejected a public petition, of which it was one of the signatories to issue an official apology for Balfour Declaration. Boris Johnson carried the Israel First conservative policy step further by placing the Zionist regime above international law. He resisted attempts to call it to account for its illegal actions and war crimes. In 2021, he announced that he opposed an international criminal court investigation into war crimes in the occupied territories, noting in a letter to CFI that while his government respected the independence of the court, it opposed this particular inquiry. Like Johnson, Truss is a passionate proponent of post-Brexit global Britain. Breaking international law, however, will do nothing to promote this brand, nor will it help to get a trade agreement with the US, which was touted as one of the major benefits of an independent foreign policy. Following Trump's example by moving the British embassy to Al-Quds would not go down well in the White House, although Biden has not reversed the move of the American embassy. He has undertaken a series of measures to limit the damage done by his predecessor, and he has reverted to working with allies through the UN. To move the British embassy from Tel Aviv to Al-Quds would be morally indefensible, legally questionable, and politically damaging. It would be one of the most savage British blows to Palestinian statehood since the Balfour Declaration. It would also encourage the Zionist regime to continue to act with impunity, reinforcing the arrogance of power. The fabricated regime of Israel and its supporters would surely welcome the move, despite the damage to Britain's standing in the world. Rather than review the location of its embassy, the British regime should reassess its relationship with the Zionist regime in light of present-day realities. In the last 2 years, reports by three major human rights organizations have concluded that the fabricated regime of Israel has become an apartheid regime. These reports carefully document the Zionist regime's ongoing ethnic cleansing, land confiscations, house demolitions, persecution of human rights defenders, detention of minors, and tolerance of settler violence. The sad truth is that since 1967, the fabricated regime of Israel has become addicted to occupation. A true friend does not indulge an addiction, but tries to win the addict from it.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is Taqwa, Thursday the 2nd of Ramadan, 1394, 19 September 1974. We should never forget the importance of right action and just rely on uttering nice words and thinking nice thoughts. Therefore, forgiveness means to heal the wounds of the human soul. By mending these tears, the human being attains perfection. This means that forgiveness is something that we should strive for, something we should compete to obtain, and something we should hasten towards. Divine forgiveness is very important. Divine forgiveness is not something that God bestows arbitrarily, according to whim or caprice. He does not make someone the object of his kindness unless that person has striven to become worthy of that kindness and hasten towards your Lord's forgiveness and a paradise as vast as the heavens and the earth, prepared for the God-weary. Sometimes we might say someone belongs in paradise, or that they will definitely go to paradise, and we sincerely hope that we are people destined for paradise. In all of our supplications, we ask Allah to grant us paradise, and sometimes we are not content with merely asking for paradise.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
We count out the blessings we want from it one by one. We ask Allah for the Hurul Ain, for its food, the meat of its birds, and the like thereof. However, it is none other than Allah Himself who says that this paradise is for those people who have taqwa. This feast has been prepared especially for them, and only they will enter this place and sit at this table. So if we want to enjoy this feast, we too must be people of taqwa. Who are the people of taqwa? Prepared for the God-weary. Pay close attention to the words of these verses. Prepared for the muttaqeen means those who have taqwa. Who are those who have taqwa? Those who spend in ease and adversity. Those with taqwa are those who spend in infaq. To spend is a condition of having taqwa. And what does spending in this sense of infaq mean? This is something we have discussed in earlier lessons, but there is no problem in repeating it here so that these words become engraved upon your hearts. Infaq is more than spending in the ordinary sense of the word. To spend ordinarily means that a person spends some money for some reason. Infaq is also spending, but it is not just any kind of spending.
You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.